Welcome to a brand new episode of the Tennis Lifestyle Podcast. I'm Gianluca Sola, your host. In this episode, I chat to David Samuel. Very excited to bring this episode. David is the author of the number one best-selling Amazon book, Locker Room Power, Building an Athlete's Mind. I read this book about 3-4 years ago. A friend of mine recommended it. And I must say, it's just one of the best books on tennis in general that I've ever read. I highly recommend it. It's a brilliant book. It talks about the mental aspect of the game, the psychology of tennis, of the game. And it's just written very well, full of useful information, tips. And it's a must read, not only if you're into tennis, but in any sport or any business or anything you do in life. It's just very, very, very good book. David is has been in tennis for over 30 years, been involved in tennis, has lots of experiences. Currently, he's the head coach for Team Bath in the UK. He was born in Johannesburg, South Africa, but spent most of his career in the UK. He was a former professional tennis player. He's been involved with the British Tennis Coaches Association, the LTA, and he's been a professional ATP coach for many years. He's been very prolific in British tennis, coaching, amongst others, Jamie Delgado, Miles McLagan. Currently, he coaches Liam Brody and Samantha Murray. He's coached also a lot of top international junior players, Davis Cup players, and also players from other countries like, for example, Wesley Moody. What else? David is also, as well as coaching, he writes a lot of articles on sports psychology and coaching, and does consultancy and mindset workshops to also other sport teams or other sports. For example, he's provided his services also to Fulham Football Club, Chelsea Football Club, and England Rugby. His latest project also is called Mindset College. It's a brand new online coaching program that will teach you the skills you need to build a strong mindset. All this information, I will put it in my episode, so you can look up all the contact details for David and his website and his social media and so on. Anyway, just the last thing about David's book. It's been also recommended by, for example, Judy Murray, she says this is a top book by a top coach. Tin Henman also, we all know this aura exists. What I like about this book is that you give it an identity. It's been praised by many people. That's about it. I've probably missed a few things about David's long career, but listen to the interview. It's a great chat. He talks about not only the book, but about many other things as well. And to finish off, thanks for everybody for listening to my podcast. It's nice. I'm getting some feedback. I really appreciate that. And please follow me, download it, like the podcast. It's available on all platforms, Google, Apple, Anchor, Spotify, and so on. You can also find me on Instagram, tennis_lifestyle_podcast. Sorry. And also on Twitter, GLSOLA. Cool. That's all. Enjoy the episode. Ciao, ciao.
Hello?
Yes. Hi, David.
Yeah.
Can you hear me well?
I can hear you, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Yes. Hi, David. Thanks very much to take some time to be on my podcast. You're currently in Spain in the Challenger Alicante with Liam Brody, am I right?
That's correct, yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I
So
saw you won yesterday.
He kind of messed up his entry, and he was going to try and play a tour event this week, but the new system is you have to enter qualifying and main draw separately, so it's like they're separate tournaments. So when I said you need to pull out of Alicante, he pulled out of the main draw and forgot to pull out of the qualifying. So as soon as he got in the qualifying in Alicante, it pulled him out of everything else. But actually, it's not been a bad thing. Right after the French to come out and have to qualify here, it's quite a difficult thing to do. But he did it and won his first round yesterday.
Fantastic.
And it's kind of kept the momentum going, which is great.
I just want to introduce you because obviously, maybe some listeners don't know who you are. But David Samuel, well, I know you because I read your book, which we'll talk about later, Locker Room Power, which is a brilliant book. But you are a professional ATP coach.
Yes.
Since 2010, you are the head coach at Team Bath in the United Kingdom, the University of Bath. And you are the author of the book Locker Room Power, Building an Athlete's Mind. You currently coach Liam Brody, but you've coached also many other players, including Jamie Delgado and also Wesley Moody. You're a sports consultant and writer. You provide sports psychology coaching workshops, and you've also provided consultancy, which is very interesting to not only tennis but to say England rugby and also football clubs, including Chelsea Football Club and Fulham Football Club.
That's
So
correct.
you've had quite I think over 30 years experience in the tennis world. I was very surprised. I didn't know this. Only when I started doing a bit of research that you were born in Johannesburg. How was it like growing up in Johannesburg?
I have to say, I mean, you don't know any different, but I had a fantastic childhood. I mean, it just existed of school and playing sport, So, I just remember, cricket, rugby, tennis, just always playing sport and in the school holidays, I always played tennis tournaments, and when I didn't have an afternoon with school sport, we'd all gather at the Wanderers Club, the best players, and just play matches against each other. I mean, in those days, I don't think I really knew what a drill was until a colleague of mine, Mark Samuels, who went to the States to Harry Hopman's and came back for a holiday and introduced us to all these different drills. Because I mean, we used to just go down, warm up and play sets. That was practice.
And maybe today there's too many drills. Maybe it should be a bit less. I don't know.
I mean, I do think I do have a theory that I think the young players today, too much of their tennis is supervised, and there's not enough sort of free tennis going on, and then the other thing is, of course, I played league tennis for my club, and it was interesting because first of all you had to break the cliques. I remember you know, being far too good for the fourth team, but being put in the fourth team because I was a junior. And, you know, all the men had been playing in these teams for years, and you know, nobody wanted to drop out of a team to let a junior in. Because, of course, part of the attraction of league is afterward having some beers and having fun.
Yeah.
And you don't want to, you know, a 15-year-old kid there. At 15, I actually won the club championships, and they kind of had to put me in the first team. But it was,
they had no option.
They had no option. Yeah. But it was actually... Yeah. You know, one of the few times I was a little bit uncomfortable because they didn't make me feel that comfortable in that first team for a while until, you know, you kind of become part of the furniture if you stay there and do well.
Which club was this?
So I played for two clubs. I played for Northern Suburbs and then I played for Ridge Park. I don't even know if it exists anymore.
Okay,
in Rosettenville. So this is all in Johannesburg. So yeah, I mean, you know, it was absolutely fantastic. And then I'd heard about getting a tennis scholarship to the States, and I just wrote off to some universities. And one of the universities I wrote to was the University of Texas, who happened to have Kevin Curran playing there. And then Kevin Curran and Steve Denton came to play the Sugar Circuit, which was, you know, the satellite. And I remember having to go to, I think it was Observatory Tennis Club, and practice with those guys. And then they phoned the coach and said I was good enough, and I got a scholarship to go to Texas.
And you were off to the USA and... Yeah. From then on, I'm not sure, but I think obviously your tennis journey led you didn't really come back to South Africa, am I correct?
But I never came back. I mean, obviously I came back for holidays, I never came. So effectively I left South Africa in 1979. And I've never lived in South Africa since then.
Since then. No, fantastic. That's very, very interesting. I mean, I've got a lot of questions for you, and I know we can't talk too long, but I'll probably be jumping from one completely question to another. So sorry for that.
That's fine.
First of all, I want to talk about your book. Your tennis journey, I know then from college, I think you went to play in the Netherlands, am I right? And then you got a job in the UK. Okay, I might be saying it a bit briefly there, but
yeah, I mean, is that correct? Once I finished college, you know, I wanted to be a professional tennis player. And that, to me... You know, the first step to being a professional tennis player is you have to make a living. You know, professional means you make your money. And the only way I could survive, I was a good college player and had played satellites in the summers and had an ATP ranking already, but essentially I wasn't able to make enough money through playing professional tennis purely through satellites because there was hardly any money in those at all. And there were very few challenges in those days and you had to kind of, you know, do really well on satellites to get to play qualifying for tour events. I mean, you know, the tour was much, much smaller. Yeah. I think, you know, in those days there were only about 600 ranked players. What I found out in my summers playing in Europe was that you could play money tournaments, you know, in France, yes. Belgium, Holland, Germany, and make some decent money, and then with that money go and play satellites. So I decamped to Europe I had a good friend in Holland, in The Hague, and based at the Scheveningen club there. And I would play money tournaments and save up my money and then go and play futures, well, not futures, satellites, and try to,
Yeah.
improve my ranking that way. And, in general, most of the time you'd lose quite a lot of money playing satellites. And when the well was kind of starting to run dry, I'd have to go back and play money tournaments again. And then, of course,
I think probably not much has changed today. It's kind of quite similar, I would say.
Yes, I mean, it's impossible to make money on futures. You just can't. The only difference is there's a lot more challenges today than there were in my day. So, and you can start to make a living on challenges if you do well on them. But you pretty much probably got to be a top 300 player to be starting to make a living at challenger level, which is a high level. I mean, it's you're a very good tennis player if you're top 300. So yeah, it's
For
very
sure.
similar, and you have to find other ways to make a living. And of course, playing for a club in Europe, and I played for the Scheveningen club, was the mainstay of my income, and around that. And then, of course, in the sort of 1986, 87, I decided, why am I doing this all the time? Playing for money, then going and blowing it all on satellites, and then having to start again. Essentially, I made the decision that I didn't believe that I was good enough to make sort of top 200. And therefore, why not just make a living playing tennis? So I stopped playing satellites and just made money playing tennis. And then what evolved is the club, the Mets that I was playing for, then asked me if I'd be player coach for the summer for the first three teams. So I did that and really enjoyed that. And then the following summer, they said, well, can you come back, be player coach for the first three teams, but also coach the top junior team? And then you can maybe do some lessons, but you can also go and play money tournaments at the same time. And I really had two fantastic years, summers really, where I made, really good money. And so much so that most of the winter, my wife and I would just, she was an air stewardess, we'd just, she would take 2 months unpaid leave. And, we actually spent one of those periods in South Africa for 2 months. And we went all over South Africa, and she got to know the country well. And I actually got to know the country a lot better, because it is an amazing place to visit. And, for a tourist, it's just unbelievable. And it was kind of crazy and strange, because the country pretty well from your childhood, but then seeing it through an adult's eyes and was very different. But I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Fantastic. Yeah, no, great. I mean, I've read up your history of your tennis journey, and I mean, there's a lot to talk about there. But if you don't mind, I want to talk about your book just a little bit, because I'm a tennis enthusiast, and I've I read a lot of books. I play tennis, blah blah blah. I listen to podcasts, and I think 3 or 4 years ago, I'm not sure. Somebody I knew said you got to read this book, and I read it, and I'm not saying this because I'm interviewing you, but I think it's the best tennis book I've ever read. It's so simple, yet what you read, you're kind of saying, well, I kind of know this, but I never think about it, and at the same time, how can I say, it's contemporary. It's a lot of these books that I've read go back 20, 30, 40 years. Yours is more now, so it's more relatable, yeah, it's just an excellent book. It's a book about obviously the psychology and the mental side of tennis, which I think as somebody gets better in the game of tennis, they kind of realize it's that side of tennis is super important. And yeah, it's just a fantastic book. I mean, I've actually summarized it. And I train with, I've got a couple of sons who play tennis. And at the end of every session, I kind of just talk about a few highlights here or there from your book. And it does make a great impact. And it's just, I would recommend it to everybody. What locker room power, which is your coaching philosophy? It's, I think you say it's desire plus weapons plus belief plus results. If you have to summarize in a few sentences, what is locker room power, and what made you write this book?
Good question, and thank you very much for that. And I'm really pleased that you enjoyed it. And I do believe that every tennis player would benefit from reading the book, because it's something that once you read it is very obvious. But like Tim Henman said, we all knew that this existed. The thing I like is you've given it a name. And essentially, how this started is in 1996, I started working for the LTA as a national coach, basically on tour with some of the best male players. So outside of Henman and Rozetsky, I had the next bunch, which was Andrew Richardson, Jamie Delgado, and a guy called Nick Gould. And we started traveling around and going to tournaments. And definitely they had a problem. And the problem was they thought that, basically players from other countries were mentally tougher than they were. And, it was something obviously that if you believe that someone's mentally tougher than you are, it's quite hard to beat them. And I started talking to them about locker room power and how they are in the locker room and how they are presenting themselves, and the fact that if they weren't owning their own space, that they'd walk into the locker room and basically almost be fans of the other players. That, wow, these guys are so good. And I said, look, I can relate to it 100%. And it's a lesson that I had to learn was when I first went out on the tour, obviously, Borg and was king, and Mats Wilander then was coming, and the Swedes had a reputation of being, really cool and calm and mentally incredibly strong. And it was very hard to beat them because you just thought, they were just these, Iceman who didn't feel anything. And it was a myth, but a very good myth, and helped them a lot. And it wasn't until I actually played doubles with and roomed with a Swede. I remember his last name. I don't actually remember his first name right now. And this guy was all over the shop. I mean, he was a good tennis player, but a basket case. And in traveling with him for 5 weeks, this whole myth of the Swedes being totally together and knowing exactly what they're doing and being so tough and everything like that was blown away. And I start to realize that I also kind of you know, thought that, you know, Americans and you know Italians and that, you know somehow, you know, knew more and were a lot stronger than I was. And so, you know, I explained it to these guys. And I said, look, you know, at the end of the day, every player has their issues and their problems. And when you go out playing, you need to find out what their issues are. And you need to probe them and test them and really go at them. And don't believe this nonsense that they somehow are tougher than you are. And also we did some practical things to put some, I suppose, fear and also just to put ourselves on the map, which is I made sure that we get up and practice, you know, two or three times a week really early, like, you know, 8 in the morning. And if it was the indoor stuff, you know, 6 in the morning before anybody else. So they'd come to the club and see that we've already practiced or we're still already practicing. And I say to the guys, you know, this works on their heads. It's like, you know, we want to be known as the hardest workers, you know, on the Challenger Tour and build a reputation and start to build our own locker room power. And, you know, so I started talking to them a lot about locker room power. And then, you know, I realized how important this was. And as they got over this, they started to do very well. And the myth in their head that other nationalities were tougher than they were started to break down, and they started to think of themselves as being, you know, tougher than other players. And of course, when they won matches against, you know, good players, I would, you know, illustrate that point to them as, listen, you know, you thought this person was mega tough. You've just beaten them, you know, that's because you're mega tough. But there were definitely actions behind it. We worked very hard, you know, to have the substance behind it. And they actually were becoming better tennis players. And therefore, they started to understand that they had their own locker room power. And that really helped their careers.
Yeah, because I was going to say it's too simple just to talk about it. I do realize it's such a complex discussion to have. But, I mean, it's a process. You don't just wake up one morning and you're mentally tough, obviously. It's a process that involves many details, many things, you know, many aspects. So it's obviously a process. And like in your book, you talk about, I mean, I'm not going to talk about all of them, otherwise we'll be here all day, but about competitiveness, weapons, enthusiasm, fear, belief, confidence, blah, blah, blah. And all of these aspects are important, maybe some more than others, and that what's creates your locker room power.
Interrupt there. Yeah. A big key, which I did with all of the players and I still, you know, do it to this day, is the first thing a player needs to know is what their weapons are. You know, what is it that you have that can hurt your opponents? Because you have to build your game around your weapons. And
Can I interrupt you? Because this is a question I wanted to ask you on weapons. Is that you go? You say that you need at least two weapons, and you need to work on your weapons. And obviously, people might think, well, it's a forehand or whatever, but it's not true. It can be anything. It could be your speed, your footwork, your mental toughness, whatever, your flexibility. But you need two weapons, and you need to work on those two weapons. Okay, I understand that, but don't you feel that if you don't, what does that mean? That's what I want to ask you. I mean, let's say as a junior player, you've got a good serve and a forehand. Are you saying just focus on those? And you know, if your backhand's a bit dodgy, okay, just leave that. What do you mean by that?
If you also read, I say your weaknesses need to be good enough.
Yes.
so that you can use your weapons. So
Okay.
you know,
Yes. Okay.
if
That's
you've got a backhand that breaks down, you know, second ball, you'll never get a chance to use your forehand. So, you know,
Yeah. Okay.
it's it you know, and really tennis today, you know, nobody there's nobody you can play and say, oh, just hit to his backhand and you'll win.
Yes.
Everybody all round is pretty strong, but you have to have two things minimum that you know can really hurt your opponents, and that if you get a chance to, you know, hit your inside out forehand or whatever, you can start to get on top of a point because of the weapon that you have, and therefore, you know, you get your confidence from your weapons, because those are the things that are going to win you the points. But you have to be able to stay in the points long enough in order to use them. And of course, the higher you get, the longer you have to stay in points, and you might have to use your weapon 3, 4, 5, 6 times in a row before it actually wins the point. You know, and so, you know, it's got to be, you know, a really good weapon, and you've got to be good enough all around to stay in points long enough, as I said, to use those weapons. So I'm not saying you just do not work at your weaknesses at all, but always your head must come around to the fact that the way you're going to win matches is with your weapons. The way you're going to stay in matches is by being strong enough all round to use the weapons. And you know, I mean, I would add one other thing, is that one of the weapons you kind of have to have is focus, because if you don't focus, and you can't concentrate, you know, for, you know, 2 hours or more, you know, obviously everybody has, you know, you lose a bit of rhythm and you lose a bit of focus, but bring it back and overall be able to stay, you know, in a tennis match for 2 hours. None of the other stuff will actually work.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's an I was going to arrive to get to that point as well, because you talk about competitiveness, and that for me is the most interesting personally part of your book, and what I think is so important. And I just want to maybe ask you to elaborate on that, because I play myself, and you say that you need to attain a state of mind, or you need to train your mind to stay in the present, because only like that you can be competitive. And I understand that completely, because I mean I'm a very average player, but when I go and play a match, and I see this also with other kids, for example, juniors, is it's so difficult to stay in the present and to focus on the present. Your mind, as you say, over 2 hours, you start thinking ahead. I'm going to win this easily. Oh my God, he's beating me. Or what are they going to think? Your mind can start thinking a million things, or you can go to the past and start thinking, oh, if I only had converted that break point and da 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 da. And there's nobody there in the present to play that point while your mind is thinking that. You call it the mind stretch, to be able to monitor the mind stretch. Now, that is incredibly difficult, in my opinion, to do. And I don't know if professionals are able to do that, but I'm sure they are. But is there any tricks, or is that down to practice or training? I mean, I know of one thing that helps me a little bit, and I stole this from a YouTube video I saw from a coach many years ago, saying use what's important now. So whenever you are serving or returning and a point, you ask yourself what's important now, and your mind goes back to the present. But even that's difficult. What's your well, you talked about this in your book very well. What's your thoughts on
Yeah, I
that?
mean, look, this is the big challenge for every human being, to stay in the present. And you know, you don't get paid millions of dollars to be the best in the world because it's easy. It's very, very difficult. And, you know, the best proponent of this by a country mile, I think, is Rafael Nadal. You know, he has trained his mind to always see the opportunity and you know, not drift into the past or the future. And he's brought it back to the present so often that he's actually incredibly good at staying in the present. In my experience, there is only one way, and that's discipline. And the discipline is simply this. Okay. Whenever you catch your mind in the past or in the future, bring it back. So it's like, no, right here, right now, this point. Okay. And then...
And eventually it will just happen. And,
you know, exactly.
If you and do I, it over
I,
and over.
I say to kids a lot, and the reason they don't get it is because they get tired and they forget and don't really realize the importance of it. But there are matches where you will have to do this maybe 100 times. You know, you bring him back to the present, and then, you know, a couple of minutes later or 5 minutes later, you realize you've been all over the place. But as soon as you realize you're all over the place, bring it back. Say, no, come on, right here, now, this point. You know, and try to get a habit, like, before each point. Say, okay, right now, this point. Now, just because you're saying right now, this point, doesn't mean your mind's still not kind of fighting and you know, right here, now, this point here, but please don't miss this return. No, come on, this point. And this fight, you know, has to be won. And it can only be won by repetition. Bring it back, bring it back, bring it back. Till almost in the end, I would say that someone like Nadal, his brain kind of knows, you know,
he doesn't have to do it.
Because even if you do, he'll bring you back anyway. Yeah. You know, so it's almost like you win the battle, your brain gets tired, and it's like, okay, I give up. I'm going to stay in the present. You know, but you know, this takes, you know, not 1, 2, 5, 10 matches. You know, this takes years. Years to get really good at this.
Yeah.
And most people don't have the patience to just keep at it and keep at it, because it's not easy, and it's kind of like a battle of wills, and it's the will to stay in the present versus you know, the will to just let your mind run rampant. And and then, of course, that's the first battle, and then the second battle of wills is your will versus the opponent's will. And those two battles are really, you know, the essence of becoming a very, very good tennis player. And there's no way around it. I wish, you know, if I had an easier way, trust me, I would give it to you. But I've, you know, in all my experience, I haven't found an easier way.
Do you believe there is quite a lot of talk in these last few years, and some players even using it? Do you believe meditation is a good option to help you in this?
Look, I think meditation is a great way to calm your mind down. You know, and I think, you know, if you meditate, you know, once a day, and also I think, you know, with meditation, you can't say I'm going to meditate for 10 minutes, in my opinion, or 15 minutes or 20 minutes. I think you need to, same thing, you need to build it. And I don't think it's really that important that maybe sometimes meditating for 3 minutes whenever you're feeling stressed can help calm you down. And if you're calmer off the court, for sure it's going to help you on the court. But ultimately, you can't meditate in a match. So it still doesn't take away the need to have this battle in your head and keep bringing your mind back to the present.
Yeah.
You know, if you start the match calmer and you start, you know, in a good place and mentally off the court, you meditate and you know, a very chilled person and calm and off the court, and I'm sure it definitely has an effect of how much maybe you have to bring your mind back to the present on the court. But it's not going to win that battle for you. It still has to be done while you're playing a match. Yeah. And there's no getting away from that.
No, that's great. There's so many things that are questions I have. This one, maybe I wanted to, it's more of a general question, but you talk about enthusiasm as well. And I think especially for, let's say, junior players, you need to learn to draw enthusiasm as an energy source. Competing and winning consistently is impossible. So you need enthusiasm, which is spot on. But, you know, you can call it enthusiasm or passion. I think that is in tennis. If you don't have that, I think you'll never make it, no matter how good you are. What is your, and this is now, that's what you say, which is, you know, I agree with 100% in your book. But taking it a bit out, tennis in the present day, especially with kids, I don't know if you deal with a lot of kids, to be honest, but, or, you know, under 18s. Yeah. Oh, do you? Do you think there is passion, enthusiasm with tennis? Do you think I'm kind of getting a very strong feeling that in today's society, I know we're always pointing the finger to technology, but, you know, this social media technology, computers, blah, 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 they are competing now. Tennis is competing not only with other sports, but with all these other things in technology that are taking time up. So the junior, so there isn't that passion anymore, or there isn't that level of enthusiasm. Is it just an impression I have, or do you get the same impression? What do you think?
No, I get the same impression. I think there's a disease out there called winitis. And winitis.
Called, sorry?
Okay.
Okay. What is that?
Basically, you know, kids play tennis to win. And if they're not winning, they lose interest. They want to win a lot. And
is that good or bad?
It's bad because wanting to win is not bad, but needing to win as the source of your enjoyment for the game is bad. The enjoyment has to come from playing the game, and winning is the icing on the cake. But they see winning as the cake, and if you can't have the winning, then there is no cake. So why be there? And I think coaches have a responsibility to explain to parents and kids what getting into tennis actually means. So, as an example, Novak Djokovic in 2013 had one of the greatest years in tennis history. Okay? What percentage of points did he win?
Well, a huge amount. Yeah. Well, no, sorry. Let me think better. Probably 51, 52%.
It was 57%. But that's on the,
which
is on the greatest year, one of the greatest years ever. He won 3 of the 4 slams, made the final of the other. I mean, no, semis of the other. I mean, amazing year. And even then, he won 11 out of 18 tournaments, which is phenomenal. Because normally the number one in the world wins about 7 out of 20 tournaments. So they're still losing 13 tournaments. And that's the number one in the world.
That's right.
Byron Black, who was a great player, never won a tour event. Top 30 player, but never actually won a tour event his whole career. So in singles.
There's many like that.
Right now, so the average points won between the players ranked between 40 and 50 in the world is 49%. They actually lose more points than they win on average. And matches won is generally from 30 onwards, less than 50% of their matches do they win. Taylor Fritz is 29 in the world right now, and he's winning less than 50% of his matches. Now, I can find a player ranked at 50 in the world, 150, 250, 500, and 1,000, and they're all winning 50% of their matches or 49% of their matches. How's that possible? Do you know how that do you know how that's possible? And this is what players need to understand. All right. The the way the point system is, is it's all about the runs that you have. So a player goes first round, second round, second round, second round, first round, first round, second round. Okay, and wins 50% of their matches is going to be ranked far lower than someone who wins a tournament and then goes 7 first rounds in a row and then makes a semi-final and then goes 7 first rounds in a row, because they'll get so many more points for winning a tournament and getting to a semi-finals. You know, as a crude example, if you're a junior and you win, the Australian Open Juniors at the beginning of the year, and that's like 1,000 points. You can lose first round.
I get what you're saying.
You'll be ranked top 30 in the world. and somebody else could win far more matches than you, but they didn't win them in a row. So for kids, they need to understand that if the best players in the world, and there's only three players who win 54% or more of their points, just slightly over 54% of their points, and that's Rafa Nadal, Novak, and and Federer. If the best in the world are only winning 54% of their points, and everybody else is averaging, around the 50% mark, losing points is a major part of the game. And if the best, a top 30 player in the world is only winning 50% of his matches or a little less, losing is a huge part of this game.
But I think sorry to interrupt you, I read a quote once from Wawrinka saying tennis is a sport where you have to, I'm paraphrasing, you have to get used to losing. I think that was a very, not used as in, you get used because you like losing, but it's because it happens all the time.
And so when the juniors need to know what they're getting into, that this is a game, the fun is trying your best to win. And it's so difficult.
But it's because today's society is about a result. You want to know something, you Google it. And 2 seconds later, you've got the best answer in the world. Why go through the fuss of trying to find out yourself in the process? The process is not what is matters.
And
anymore.
That's why
it's the end result.
You know, too many juniors are playing, and I only like this sport if I'm winning. Well, the reality is, you know, if you're amazing, you'll win, you know, 50% of your matches. Look, you have periods where you win more, and that's when you climb levels. So if you're 1,000 in the world, you suddenly have a period where you're winning 65%, 70% of your matches, and you go from 1,000 to 500. But then you're at a new level playing, you know, higher resistance, and then it comes back down again until you get used to that level. And when you when your game's good enough and you're ready to go, you'll have that spurt where you win 60, 65% of your matches and go to 300 in the world. And then it rebalances again until you get good enough to move again. And that's how the sport works. But you're never going to be winning, you know, 90% of your matches for, you know, years and years, unless, you know, unless you're Roger, Rafa, Novak, you know, Halep,
which are the
all-time greats. But even they still lose a lot of tournaments. You know, they don't win. You know, I mean, you just have to look at Novak's and Rafa's records, like at some of the slams. I mean, Novak is what now 1-5 or 1-4 at the French Open finals. You know, Rafa's 1-4 for Australian Open finals. You know, they have a lot of disappointment in their careers as well, you know, that people don't, you know, don't realize.
Don't realize, David, I know you haven't got a lot of time, and there was just a few other things I wanted to talk about, but... I'll try and go through them quickly. I mean, there's so much, but this is more, I'm just more curious. Do you kind of keep in touch with tennis in South Africa? Have you got any thoughts of how tennis is in South Africa? And if you have to compare it to maybe the UK, and how is the tennis in the UK compared to other countries?
I don't know a hell of a lot about South African tennis anymore. I have heard through the grapevine. I certainly see that there's more tournaments being put on again. Obviously, COVID has hurt that. But that, you know, there seems to be some better organization starting to happen in South Africa, which, you know, I really hope is true, because the club scene, when I've been back there, seems to have kind of died a bit of a death. And, you know, there used to be lots of club tournaments that people, you could go around playing, you know, and open tournaments, you know, Wits Open, you know, Observatory Open, all of these tournaments seem to have disappeared. And hopefully, you know, the club scene, you know, has some kind of revival. And at the tournament scene, because if you don't have a lot of tournaments, it's really, really difficult for players to learn their trade. You know, you got to play a lot of tournaments to learn your trade. And I'd say in the UK, one of the issues we have is I don't think the tournament structure is strong enough. And that, you know, we spend a lot of money on academies and training and putting, you know, amazing resources around players, but at the end of the day, you know, you got to learn your trade playing a lot more tournaments. And I think if you have a lot of tournaments, it's cheaper for people to play, because you know, in the UK, the best players travel a lot to play tournaments, which takes a lot of money. And I think that narrows the opportunities where, you know, if kids, you know, don't have a lot of money, if they can just play a lot of competitive tennis relatively cheaply close to their home, you're opening up opportunities for far more players to come through. So
would you agree that the main components in order to create a really competitive tennis country, the main components would be, in no particular order, this is sort of what I came up with, you completely disagree, you need the right climate, you need to play on clay as a junior, You have to have tons of futures and challenges. You have to have a vibrant club tennis scene, and you have to leave the coaching to the private coaches, academies, and the federation must only assist or collaborate. Well, what do you think of that?
I agree with it a lot. I think federations need to facilitate more than control. And the best way to
Yeah.
facilitate is to have a very, very good competitive structure. If you have a very good competitor, I mean, you only have to look at Italy. So many good players, and the amount of tournaments they've got in Italy. Even, India's got a lot of tournaments. And the Indian players are coming through. In the 20 years ago, when I'd go to India, the players were pretty poor. You had a few decent ones, but the rest were pretty poor. But these guys getting wild cards and stuff into loads of tournaments and loads of tournaments. Guess what? Now they can play. And there's a lot of good Indian players. And I'm convinced it's through their tournament structure. I think if you don't have the climate, that's one you mentioned, and South Africa's got great climate, so and a lot of courts, and it's therefore cheap and easy to play. Same as Spain, a lot of courts, good climate. In Northern Europe, you've got to have the indoor courts, and and that's where I think federations can facilitate, is find a way to get cheap court hours for kids to play, and practice. And then the tournament structure. So you basically hit the nail on the head. I think too many federations try to produce players, and they don't need to. Support the
Or they
well, but
don't know how
also
to, or they don't know
once
how
you
to.
take good coaches and take them into a federation and give them a salary, and they're not really accountable for what happens to the players. It takes a very rare individual to keep the same motivation and the same desire and hunger for their kids to do well, because if they don't do well, the next ones come along. And that's why keeping these better coaches out private, competing with the rest of the world, is far healthier. And have some kind of bonus system or whatever, where if their players do well, their academy gets some bonuses or whatever, if the federation has the money to do that, which I think would be very healthy. If you and you just have a system where if I'm coaching a player for 6 months, and then he leaves me and goes to another coach, and the end of the year bonus for his ITF ranking or whatever is £1,000, we both get £500. Or if it's 3 months, you just do it pro rata. But that way, you could feed some money into the academies through the kids doing, if they win nationals, they get, I don't know, £5,000. That goes to the academy that coaches the kid, or the coach that coaches the kid. And that way people can select the coaches that are doing the best. And if coaches take that money and don't reinvest in players and stuff like that, very soon they'll stop producing players, and people will vote with their feet for the best coaches. So, but I think, also, I do think that coaches and federations have a responsibility to explain what a wonderful sport it is for teaching resilience in the real world, and that you have to learn how to come back over and over again from setback after setback, because losing is such a big part of tennis, and it shouldn't be seen as a bad thing. It should be seen as a real positive, that this is an amazing sport for your mind.
David, I don't want to keep you too long. I see we've got
I've
like
got 10
if you
minutes.
I
Yeah,
don't know
I've
if
got
you've
10
got
minutes.
10 minutes. I've got this 10 minutes.
I have. I usually end my podcast with a mega rapid fire
Okay.
quiz. You can keep it very short. It's nothing
Can I just say
too
something?
complicated.
In terms of the mindset stuff and everything, obviously I have the book Locker Room Power, but I've also developed an online program called Mindset College. So mindsetcollege.co.uk. And by the end of this month, it'll be totally ready. It's got 9 modules, and it really takes you through how to deal with fear, comparison, expectation, judgment, all of the things that happen in tennis players' minds. And there's a lot of resource material and everything around it. So, if people are interested, go and have a look at Mindset College. And it's really in addition, you get the book Locker Room Power as part of the pack as well. And it's a very comprehensive mental skills program that I'm going to be rolling out to some academies and colleges who to have as a
Okay,
foundation for their
fantastic.
program.
I'll definitely. I will all this info, your website, all your social media. I'll add it to the episode as well, and so people can just go and follow
Brilliant. And if you send me
your
a copy,
website
I'll
and
put
what
it
you're
out
doing,
on my
and
stuff
also on
and see if
social
we
media.
can help your podcast reach more people.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Really appreciate that. Okay, now just back to the rapid fire. It's lots of little questions just to maybe get to know
Yeah,
you a
I'm
little
ready.
bit better. Are you ready? What is your very first memory of tennis?
Playing actually against the wall on my tennis court, playing matches against the wall. Loved them.
Define what type of player you are if someone has never seen you play tennis.
Yes. Struggle to survive in the game today, but a serve and volley, very aggressive player.
Is there a pro that would you would that resembles you or you resemble them in the style of play?
Going back a while, I mean a big hero of mine was Pancho Gonzalez. I try to model my game on his. So, I mean, probably nobody remembers him at all, but that was my role model. Probably would have won a
No,
lot
he
of
was
Grand Slams if he hadn't have gone pro.
best shot. Best shot. Your best shot.
Serve and forehand.
Is there any current player that you really enjoy watching, male or female?
For different reasons, there's a few. I mean, aesthetically, Federer at his best is just fantastic to watch. I love Nadal for the way he solves problems. I think Djokovic's length is just consistently incredible. In the woman, I do like watching Halep. I think when she's in a fighting mood, her movement is incredible, and her ability to counter punches is quite incredible. And then I quite like watching Kvitova because it's kind of shit or bust, but she hits a big ball for a woman.
List the big three from Nadal, Federer, and Djokovic from your favorite to least
Ooh.
favorite.
As I said before, I can't really because for different reasons, I think aesthetically, Roger, I think, athletically, movement and length, I think Djokovic for the mental side, and the ability to solve problems and evolve as a player, Nadal, just amazing. So,
best tournament.
Yeah, so I sat on the fence there.
Sorry.
Yeah. With good reason.
That's fine. best tournament in the world.
It's close. This, I mean, Wimbledon, because I'm so familiar with it, is just a phenomenal tournament. I also like the Australian Open a lot. It's such a casual kind of slam with a lot of space and just very, very comfortable. And then at a different level, I think Indian Wells is an amazing tournament as well. Funny enough, at 250 level, Santiago, which was a new tournament that I went to.
Yeah.
Really, really, really nice tournament. So well organized. Okay. Jaime Filol, I don't know if you remember him. Very good player from a long way back. His family run the tournament, and what a great job they did. Yes.
Okay. So Santiago in Chile. Okay. No, that's interesting. What's your favorite surface?
I actually probably grass.
Grass.
But okay. I love watching tennis on clay.
Do you have an... Okay. Do you have a favorite all-time racket?
Very little known racket, but it was the Graphite Schnauert midsize. Gray racket. Yeah, what an amazing racket.
I think I know that one. this one's a bit different. You need to book a restaurant, and you can only invite 3 players, male or female, any era. Which restaurant and which players do you invite?
Wow. What a great question. I will start with a setting that I... which restaurant? Wow. I mean, there's some great restaurants around. Yeah.
Or just one of your favorite, let's say. Yeah.
There's a restaurant in Paris that's on the top of, I think it's a Marriott Hotel, a rooftop. It's right next to Roland Garros. And it's a rooftop restaurant, and you got a view of the city, good food. So I'll select that for the moment. And who 3 players I'd invite? Roger for sure. Martina Navratilova. And Pancho Gonzalez.
Okay, that's nice combo, very nice. And the food there is Moroccan French, I'd imagine.
So it's like a fusion of Moroccan and French. Nice. It's some very interesting dishes.
Do you like cooking? favorite food?
I mean, I go through phases. I'd say I really like Mexican. I really like Mexican. Yes, yeah.
Do you bribe? You still bribe
either? And that's the thing is, I mean, it's food. I mean, a great Indian, good Thai curry. I mean, wow. I love food, so there's that, you know,
Anything.
there's never a shortage of great stuff to eat. Yeah, so I love so much different foods. I might not like cooking it, but I do love eating it. Yeah.
Pizza, light eating. Do you have a favorite pizza
I
topping?
mean, I'm
What do you go
probably
for
my
if you
standard
get a
is ham and
pizza?
mushroom. Yeah.
Okay.
Tea.
Tea or coffee? Favorite cocktail if you drink?
I think, I mean, I'm not really a cocktail person, so I'd say probably whiskey and ginger ale.
Okay. Do you have any interesting hobbies? Oh.
I mean, I like walking in the hills. I really do like that. And I love reading.
Okay.
So, not very
Okay.
interesting. Not very interesting. Nothing.
See, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
No, but I mean
Yeah.
it's no, not true. Reading's good. If you have to choose sea, city, mountain, or
City,
countryside, which
mountain, or
one do you prefer?
countryside, or sea.
Or sea.
I think I'd go sea, yeah.
See. A lot of tennis players are
No.
superstitious. Are you
I
superstitious?
try to not. I try to. I mean, it's not easy, but I
No.
try to knock it out of players. You don't need luck to win. You don't need. But you know, then they go and see Nadal is
Okay.
incredibly superstitious. So, I mean, most players have some kind of
Yeah.
superstitions, but I try to knock it out of them.
Okay. Your favorite country to visit? It can't be, let's say, South Africa or the UK where you live.
Italy. And I would really like to discover
Okay.
more about Chile and South America.
Is
Watching?
there other sports you enjoy?
Yeah, I really
Yeah,
love a
watching or
lot of
playing.
sports. I think I have a pretty good knowledge of a huge amount of sports from NBA basketball to rugby, cricket.
Okay.
I follow a lot of sport. You know, I mean, you know, I'll even follow results in snooker and I mean, I'll there's not a lot of sports where I don't know something about. It is a, I suppose, in a way, maybe I've never thought of it this way, but I suppose that's a hobby of mine is I kind of keep up with a hell of a lot of sports. You know, I mean, I'll even, sevens
Would you
rugby.
say,
You know, I mean, yeah. No, I'm a sport. I suppose I'm a sports nut. Yeah.
not.
I
Is
would say
tennis
so,
the
yes.
most difficult sport in
I
the world?
think you got the mental is such a big part of it. Physically, you have to be in such great shape and all-round strength. I don't, you know, there are sports that'll match it. Golf, obviously, mentally is a huge challenge, but I don't think physically you have to be in the same place as tennis. You know, if you see, you know, the French Open final, you know, a couple of days ago. I mean, the enormous athleticism and sustainability over hours, and to mentally stay on it with all of that physical output, I think. And it's obviously gladiatorial one-on-one, different surfaces, you know, different balls, so many different conditions, indoors, outdoors. You know, it's so varied. I'd say that you have to be incredibly adaptable and versatile to play good tennis. It's, yeah, I don't think there's a tougher sport.
Do you think in 2050, so 30 years from now, tennis will be very different, or will it be much the
It's a
same?
great question that, you know, because you always sort of wonder how it can evolve much more than it has. I mean, I certainly have some inklings as to where it can go. I think it, I, again, I think everything will still be faster. I do think that all-round tennis will be, you know, the ability to come forward to the net more than is happening at the moment will re-emerge. I think, you know, we talk about weapons and weaknesses. I think the gap between weapons and weaknesses will narrow and continue to narrow. It's but I can't imagine it being vastly different from how it is today, because I can't imagine, you know, how much harder people can hit the ball, and you know, 3 or 4 mile an hour more. So it will definitely get quicker, but
Quicker.
and a little bit more all around. But I think it will still be you know, quite recognizable to today's.
Nearly finished. Your all-time tennis player, I'm gonna give you all the shots and options. You just name a male or female or any era.
Pete
You have to
Sampras.
pick one serve. Return.
Say Novak or Andre Agassi.
Forehand.
Gonna say Rafa Nadal. But I've always thought his
After this
forehand is
French
very
Open.
difficult to handle.
Yeah, no. Backhand.
Backhand.
Backhand. Yeah.
I think there's a difference between one, two hands. So, I mean, one-handed, I'd go Stan and Hennen, and two-hander.
Okay.
I'd put Andy Murray up there.
Okay, interesting. Volley.
Edberg and Martina for the woman. Martina
Drop shot.
Navratilova. Sorry, volley was Navratilova
Move. Oh, do you want to give a mini one?
and Edberg. Drop
Oh,
shot.
yeah.
Well, until the final, I would have said Novak.
Yep. Yeah, it didn't work very well in the first
Yeah.
game
Drop shot.
yeah.
On his day, yeah,
Curious,
checking
no.
out.
Checking out.
You know, I've got this memory of Francois Dere. I mean, probably people haven't heard of a French Open champion a long time ago, but amazing drop shot. Yeah, go and look it up.
I will. Movement.
I'd say Halep and Novak. Yeah, that's easy. Well, it's actually
Mentality.
two
I
in
think I know
history,
what you're
Nadal
going to
and
say
Borg.
here.
I mean, Borg phenomenal in that, you know, there are players who, you know, like Sampras and you know, Nadal, who very seldom show a negative, Federer, but they will show a positive. and Borg never showed negative or positive, which mentally is incredibly, I don't think it'll ever happen again, actually. It's just a phenomenal control. It's just, wow. You know, so, you know, I've never known anybody to not show the positive or the negative. Probably Mackinac.
Touch, feel, touch. Okay. And last one, personality. You have to choose on court, off, all round personality, off court.
It depends whether you're looking for bad boy or good boy or good girl. I think overall impact. I mean, for longevity and impact, you know, you got to say Federer. For immediate impact, Boris Becker, when he won Wimbledon at 17 and 18. I mean, phenomenal impact. You know, so, you know, there are different reasons.
Yeah,
you know,
I agree.
Nastasi for just craziness.
Yeah.
And Borg. Yeah,
and probably Borg for bringing Beatles, tennis, you know, to superstar, the world.
You know,
maybe.
First sort of
like
rock star type, you know, huge impact.
Yeah.
So, yeah, for different reasons, different personalities. I mean, you know, but I mean, I think we've been very lucky with Nadal and Federer and, you know, in this era, you know, and the four of them, Novak and Andy. And so, I mean, there's been a lot of, you know, great stuff together at the same time. Okay.
We are nearly finished. The last question, and then I'll leave you. You've been really, really nice. Yourself a question and answer it.
No.
It doesn't have to be personal. It can be any.
Is and I think it's a good question for anybody to ask themselves is, how much of a hypocrite am I? Because we're all got, you know, our lenses that we look at ourselves with, and we can all be hypocritical as people. You know, that's just part of human nature. And I think you've got to try to humble yourself and say, you know, look for the places where you're being hypocritical. And I think that can keep your feet on the ground pretty well.
Yeah, fantastic. Very nice. Thank you. Thank you, David. I really, really enjoyed this. I mean, it was really nice speaking to you. As I said, I love your book, and I've taken so much from it and learned so much from it. And it's just been really, really nice to be able to talk to you. And thanks for giving your time. And I hope also good luck with the tournament.
And thanks for having me on the podcast.
And yeah, and great speaking to you.
had me rocking and rolling there. So fantastic. And good luck with this project. And I hope it goes from strength to strength. Okay. Take care. Cheers.
Great. Bye. Okay. Thanks a lot. Have a good day.